This is A Coastal Story, written and presented by Charlie Connolly. At 6 o'clock on the bright, warm morning of the 18th of June 1928, 74-year-old David Cargill and a 35-year-old, also called David Cargill, but confusingly no relation, set out from the harbour at Auchmithie on the east coast of Scotland in Blossom, a 16-foot crab boat, for a morning's fishing. Old Davy, as he was known in the village, had been a fisherman all his life, just like his father before him, and the younger David was only in his second week on the boat. The sky was clear and blue and the sea was calm, so when they hadn't returned by lunchtime, nobody was particularly concerned. By tea time, however, people began to worry. And as the sun began to dip towards the horizon, the villagers began searching. By 10 o'clock that evening, two aircraft from Lucas had joined the search, but there was no sign of boat or Davies. The following day, an oar washed up, and then a crab pot with two crabs inside. 2 days after that, a fisherman noticed a cork floating on the surface about 200 yards from the shore, tied to a rope that was attached to something below. 4 fathoms down, the Blossom still had her sails set. The younger David's coat was still attached to a peg, but there was no sign of either man. Both were greatly missed. The younger David had a wife and a child. Old Davy was a widower and one of the most popular characters in the village. And, 7 years earlier, one of the stars of Auchmithie's Moment in the Spotlight. They came from all directions. Over the cliffs, over the rocks, along the road from Arbroath, on foot, on bicycles, the occasional car, half a dozen trucks with as many curious folk crammed into the back as possible. Hundreds of people on that first day alone. Auchmithie felt like it was the centre of the world. Auchmithie had never seen anything like it. In that warm spring of 1921, little had changed in Auchmithie since Sir Walter Scott visited way back in 1815. He'd loved the whitewashed stone cottages huddled on the red sandstone cliff so much he put it into his novel, The Antiquary, and called it Mussel Crag. If Scott had returned more than a century later, he would have found that almost nothing had changed. The cottages were still there with their thatched roofs and whitewashed walls, and life in Auchmithie went on just as it always had. Focused entirely on the sea, the men still descended the path to the small ancient harbour and headed out in their boats, and the women helped unload the baskets and gutted and prepared the fish, and then they sold the fish. The same rhythms, the same routines, year in, year out, played out just as they were on coasts all around these islands. The tide came in, the tide went out. The seasons changed. There were storms. But Auchmithie kept to itself, kept to its routine. And then the film people came. They took over the White Hart Hotel in Arbroath, where Scott had stayed, where Robert Burns had stayed, booking out every room in the place for the director, the producer, the camera people, the lighting people, the wardrobe people, the technicians, the makeup people, and of course the actors, the bona fide, glamorous film stars. Auchmuty had been selected by the British production company Broad West as the exteriors location for a screen adaptation of Charles Reade's 1853 novel Christie Johnston. He's all but forgotten now, but Charles Reade was one of the most popular English novelists of the 19th century. When he died in 1884, Charles Dickens attended his funeral. Christie Johnston told the story of a depressed aristocrat, Viscount Ibston, who is prescribed a period of rest among the poor. He arrives in a Scottish fishing village, meets the eponymous heroine, and decides to assist her in winning the heart of a local artist. The interior scenes would all be shot at the Broad West studio in Walthamstow, so the east coast of Scotland was a bit of an expedition for the company and its equipment. And they only had a week in Auchmuty, during which they were restricted to daylight hours in good weather. So every minute, every foot of film had to count. On some days they would shoot more than 30 different scenes around the village, in the harbour, and up on the cliff tops. But what made the occasion even more exciting was that director Norman MacDonald wanted to use as many as 60 of the villagers themselves as extras. "Just be your natural selves," he told them as he set up his shots. "Do what you'd normally do. All I ask is that you don't look at the camera." It's hard to be your natural self when there's a man pointing a big box on a tripod at you, not to mention the crowds of people lined up behind him and strung out along the hill above and tucked out of sight in the lanes and closes. They were used to the roar of the wind and the crash of the waves, but this sea of voices that rose and fell with the activity of the crew and the actors, well, that was something else altogether. And the actors, how strange they looked. Every gesture expansive, every facial expression exaggerated in this play without words, without sound. How long the days were that week when their time and their village was not their own. The fishermen, like old Davy, eyeing the sea, wishing they were out there rather than being posed with their crab pots and nets and sent out into the harbour in their boats, but not too far in case you had to come back and do it again. And all the time thinking, "The tide's wrong for this. We wouldn't be doing this now. What if somebody sees?" And the light would start to fade, and the actors would sit and talk to the villagers while the equipment was packed up, and the crowds would melt away again. And there was old Betty Cargill, Auchmuty to her bones, in her eighth decade, and never been further than Arbroath, sitting outside her cottage with Gertrude McCoy, playing Christie Johnston, perched on her doorstep, elbows on her knees, pale with the thick makeup, hands clasped by her face. The former Gibson girl and star of the New York studios, who'd crossed the Atlantic to marry an Englishman, asking Betty about her life in the rhythms and cadences of Atlanta, Georgia. And smiling and nodding as Betty answered almost impenetrably in her Auchmuty tones, her face creasing into wide toothless grins, throwing her head back and laughing her noiseless laugh at some of the questions from this strange, beautiful, alien creature with her shiny white face and smooth, slim, ivory hands that had never gutted a fish. Nearby, the star of the film, the leading man, one of the most famous film actors in England, Stuart Rome, real name Septimus Riot, playing the Viscount. He stood with old Davy and the other fishermen, feeling ridiculous in his white suit and green top hat among their dark blue caps, Guernseys and trousers. The Auchmuty men were unable to stop looking him up and down in his strange clothes and making awkward, stilted conversation. 6 years earlier, Stuart Rome had been voted second only to Charlie Chaplin as Britain's favourite film star. And it was quite refreshing, in a way, to find that these men had not the slightest idea who he was, just a stranger, in strange clothes, face pale with makeup, black lines around his eyes, trying to sound knowledgeable about fishing and the sea, even though he was from Berkshire. He did have stories he could tell, of being an engineer in a Coventry factory, of emigrating to Australia and going bankrupt trying to start a sheep station, and only taking up acting when he came back to Britain in his late 20s. He was 36 now, getting long in the tooth for a leading man. Whatever the makeup wizards could do, every film now he wondered if it might be his last in this ruthless business. As the days passed, the crowds came from farther and farther afield, from Forfar and Dundee, even Edinburgh. When they filmed a scene among the ruins of Arbroath Abbey, the town came almost to a standstill, everyone filling the streets from the town centre to the abbey. The cast had never signed so many autographs. Clive Brook looked out from the White Hart at the packed streets below and wondered what on earth the appeal was. He was a man of the stage who found cinema slightly vulgar, with its call for hammy histrionics, and he was usually only tempted in front of the camera by the money. When offered Christy Johnston, he saw the week on the east coast of Scotland at least as a kind of honeymoon after his marriage to the actress Mildred Evelyn, for whom he'd secured a small part in the film. She'd nursed him through the aftermath of the war, where he'd been briefly buried alive by a shell explosion at Messines in 1918, and still suffered from terrible nightmares and occasional bouts of amnesia. If one thing was to be said for cinema, there were no lines to learn, only movements and gestures. His memory would come back, he was sure of that. And the sea air was doing him good. Not a single nightmare since they'd left London. And at least he could laugh on the last day of filming. In one scene he was to ride side by side with Gertrude McCoy and Mercy Hatton playing the Viscount's fiancée. The only horses in town smart enough for the camera came from the local funeral parlour. And try as they might, nobody could persuade them to walk abreast. They did what they always did, in single file, the spaces in between them almost exactly the length of a hearse. When the film people left, silence descended again on Auchmuty. There had been goodbyes, surprisingly emotional ones. Gertrude McCoy bewildering Betty Cargill by throwing her arms around her neck in a warm farewell embrace. Stuart Rome shook the hands of the fishermen, and they wished him luck that he thought he might well need. Mercy Hatton played with the children one last time. Clive Brook and Mildred took one last stroll around the harbour at Arbroath, hand in hand, a full week without a nightmare. He'd never slept more soundly. And Arbroath fell into its old rhythm, and Auchmuty fell into its old rhythm, and the summer came, and the autumn, and the winter storms, and the tide came in and went out, and the crab yield was good, and the herring continued to bite. And then, one day in the spring of 1922, some round silver tins arrived at the Palace Theatre in Arbroath, and electricity filled the air again. They had a special gala screening that first night, bringing the whole of Auchmuty to the palace. The fishermen and the fishwives and the children sat in the velvet seats, and the lights went down, and the musicians at the front, pinpricks of light on their music stands, began playing Scottish tunes. And then the screen lit up and filled with the title card of Christy Johnston. And their awestruck faces were lit with the light from the screen as Stuart Rome appeared, and Gertrude McCoy, and Clive Brook, and Mercy Hatton. And then there was Auchmuty, the streets, the harbour, sights at once familiar yet strangely displaced, sitting there in the dark in our broth. And there were the children running through the streets, and Betty Cargill outside her house, and down at the harbour as the actors waved their arms and pulled their faces, there were the fishermen, and old Davy sitting in his velvet seat with his face lit by a smile and lit by his own image shining from the screen. The gasps and delighted cries of recognition rang out with each scene, and when the plot threads were neatly tied and the words "the end" appeared, they clapped their hands and stamped their feet and talked of nothing else for days. They played Christy Johnston at the Palace every year after that, the pops and flashes and bleached gouges getting worse with every screening, and still they came, to see themselves preserved as they were that week in April 1921. And every year there were more faces alive only on the screen, like old Davy Cargill, working his crab pots on the harbour like he always did, like he did on that bright sunny morning in 1928 when he never came home. Christy Johnston was a big hit. For years afterwards, sightseers came to Auchmuty, coach parties sometimes, strangers standing where Stuart Rome had stood and talking to old Betty Cargill about Gertrude McCoy, eyes flashing with the magic of cinema. And the actors went their own ways in the world. Mercy Hatton had waved goodbye to Auchmuty, promising she'd return for a holiday. And 3 years after filming, she did just that, booking into the White Hart again with her husband and marvelling at how the children had grown. Gertrude McCoy, once spoken of in the same breath as Mary Pickford and Theda Bara, never made the transition to talkies. She and her husband returned to America in the 1930s to care for Gertrude's ailing mother, and she drifted away from the film world altogether. At the peak of her fame in 1915, a cinema opened in Baltimore named after her, and the opening night was a gala of red carpet and flashing bulbs and a screening of one of her films. Within 20 years, she was working as a hotel receptionist in Atlanta. One of the obituaries after her death in 1967 noted that the building that had opened as the Gertrude McCoy Picture Theatre was now the low-cost food store. Stuart Rome did slightly better than he might have feared after Christy Johnston. The advent of talkies didn't finish his career, but he kept working in minor roles all the way up to 1950. He died in 1965, his death unremarked, the fate of most of Britain's early film stars of the silent era. Clive Brook came to embrace the screen, relocating to Hollywood in 1924 and becoming a star of the American screen, most notably opposite Marlene Dietrich in Shanghai Express in 1932, by when he was receiving 12,000 fan letters every week. He gave it all up when he was made aware of a plot to kidnap his baby son, moving his family back to England and returning to the stage. The nightmares never came back. The White Hart Hotel, where Walter Scott stayed, where Robert Burns had stayed, where Stuart Rome and Gertrude McCoy and Clive Brook and Mercy Hatton had stayed, is now a solicitor's office and a shop selling cheap household products. The Palace Theatre, where the people of Auchmuty watched themselves on the screen, was knocked down in 1939 and replaced by a purpose-built cinema, which lasted until the 1990s, until it too was demolished in favour of a sheltered housing unit. Auchmuty is still pretty much as it was then. The seasons pass, the tide goes in and out, children run through the streets. As for the reels in those old round film tins, the celluloid rotted, or wore down, or broke, or burned through, until, like the majority of films of the silent era, no copies of Christy Johnston survive today. With the passing years, the number of locals whose faces had appeared on the screen grew fewer and fewer, until there was nobody who even remembered that magical week when the movies came to Auchnevy. And the village saw itself up there, on a huge screen in the palace, believing that those moments would live forever and that they would live forever, that those marvellous days were preserved when people came from all directions, over the cliffs, over the rocks, along the road from Arbroath, on foot, on bicycles, the occasional car, half a dozen trucks with as many curious folk crammed into the back as possible, hundreds of people every day, when Auchmuty felt like the centre of the world, when Auchmuty had never seen anything like it. And that was A Coastal Story, and I'm Charlie Connolly, and that is it for Series 4 of Coastal Stories. Thanks a million to everyone for listening and all your kind messages and tweets and suggestions and all the reviews and ratings. We'll be back with a new series after a short break. In the meantime, don't forget you can fill this temporary void with books that I've written. Attentional Shipping and The Channel would slake your coastal thirst until we're back with Series 5. Coastal Stories is researched, written, presented and produced by me, Charlie Connolly, and listened to by you, the people listening. We'll see you again soon for Series 5.